You're listening to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Gromadsky, and today I'm going to be talking to Kevin Annett, who is CFO North America at Barrick Gold Corporation. Thanks for being on today, and how are you doing?
Thanks, Alex. Good. Very good. Thanks.
Well, Barrick Gold's an interesting and exciting company, given that all of us are to some degree familiar with gold. What is it like working at that type of company? And what's your career path been to become CFO of such a, I'll say, iconic company? At least as far as I know, they're iconic.
Yeah, well, I like to think so as well. So, what is it like? It's very interesting and certainly from a standpoint of having sort of different things to work on and work with, you know, not all mines are created equal. Actually, most mines are different from one another. They all have their sort of own intricacies, whether it be ground conditions, the amount of gold that's in the ground. So, the costs vary quite significantly. So, it's definitely been interesting. I've been with Barrick now for 8 years, 8+ years. I started at one of the operations here in Ontario in Canada back in 2015 as the finance manager for that site, and worked my way up from there. And here I am today as the CFO for all of North America. You know, North America is a pretty big region of Barrick. Barrick's divided into three regions. We have Africa and the Middle East, Latin America and Asia Pacific, and then North America. North America is about 52-53% of the company.
So I got to ask, so being on site or being a site CFO, so were you then looking at gold and seeing gold and holding gold? And what was it like? I'm going to assume if you're at the mine, so to speak, I only see the bars and the coins, but I'm assuming the raw version is very different.
The raw version is very different, and it depends. It varies from site to site because of the impurities that you get. And impurities, are often either silver, copper, and then there's other impurities that are in. So what we call them they're not gold bars. What we call them is doré bars. And they're about 80% pure gold at that point when they leave our site. And then they'll go to a refinery. And then that's where they get turned into, 0.99% pure gold. As a site CFO, every week on a very specific day of the week, we would pour gold, and then you'd have these massive bars, and gold is very heavy. So if you think of a bar that's about the size of maybe your laptop computer. You're straining to get it from a moving cart onto a table to get weighed. It's not as shiny and lustrous, as you would think, especially in a doré form. That site where I worked, the impurity was silver. So it still had that gold color, but a lot of places, if the impurity is copper, it looks more like a copper bar than a gold bar. It has that sort of copper color, the kind of like a brass fitting or a copper fitting that you would see in the plumbing in your house. That's sort of the color that the gold bar gets shipped as when it leaves our site. So.
Oh, so it's not as beautiful as the final refined product that is maybe I can.
No, and it's kind of bumpy and yeah, it's not, it doesn't look that great at all.
Yeah. So then going from site CFO to, I'm going to say, having to look and evaluate what that looks like and oversee that site and if it's profitable or not. Now, being CFO of North America, how is that role obviously different and changed, and how has your experience grown over the years?
Yeah, I mean, the role is very different, in terms of what I'm doing, but also obviously the quantum of what I'm doing. When you're at a site, especially the one that we had in Northern Ontario was fairly simple. We're 100% owner of that site. So, you're kind of looking every day to your point, whether you're being profitable, that day, that week, that month, whatever the case may be. Now, that part of my job hasn't changed. I still worry about being profitable and making money, but I also now interact a lot, obviously a lot more with the market and kind of dealing with analysts and how they sort of value our company as a whole, but then also I'm interested in how they're valuing specific assets, specific mines, for example. And then obviously we have the operations that sit in North America, but we have a lot of sort of joint ventures and projects that aren't producing yet. We have a pretty significant closure portfolio of assets, so mines that are now closed, but you still have to monitor the environment, and there's still spend that happens there, and some of them have obviously more spend than others, but overall it's a pretty busy role.
Yeah. No, so it sounds like you said you have the closed sites that aren't producing anymore, but you maybe have some environmental cleanup and getting rid of everything over there to reclaim it, put that site back in place. Then you have the operational sites, and then you have sites that you have acquired or own the rights to, but they're not being mined yet. So is that kind of the three buckets?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the close, like the I'll say the bigger liability closed sites that we have are actually sites that we got through an acquisition, where we wanted an asset that was generating cash, but you end up with the closure property, sort of at the same time. So
Makes sense. And then how do you decide which projects you guys decide to work on and when? Because gold is a commodity, right? So I'm assuming a lot of your profits are related to commodity price. Do you guys do some speculating or forecasting as what future is going to be, or is it kind of based on manpower availability, operational, or is there any, I'm going to say, labor constraints, or is it just purely timing of cash flows and capital expenditures?
Well, it's not so much the timing. I mean, obviously, not all projects are independent, in so much that there's only so much capital available to deploy. We haven't run into that issue yet. So the way we operate, Alex, in terms of capital allocation, is we have a very strict investment filter, which is the project has to make 15% at $1,300 gold. So all our future forecasting and modeling is done at 1,300. So we do that to keep a capital discipline, and also it protects us from the downside risk of the commodity price. And then if you can make a project make money at $1,300 gold, then you're just, anything above that is just gravy, essentially, right? So that's our investment filter. That we apply sort of broadly is 13, 15% return IRR at $1,300 gold price.
That sounds like a very good IRR at that gold price, especially since prices are, I think, like 1900 right now or in that range. So, but I'm assuming you then have some projects.
Today they jumped up today. They're at 2066 today. So I'm almost hitting that all-time high there, so.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So does that then mean, well, I'm assuming then, therefore, the majority of your project, I'm assuming, are making money then, but there's still some that don't make money. How would those projects that aren't making money at 1,300 gold ever make money? I guess is then my question. Are those just site remains closed, or do you ever bring your prices down?
Well, the site doesn't remain closed. Like, for example, a project that hasn't kicked off yet.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah. Sorry.
what that makes us do, or and the work that triggers, is okay. Well, how can you look at it differently? In order for it to meet that hurdle rate. Now, I will say that sometimes we do deviate from that hurdle rate. We can, a long life asset. If you're thinking about a mine that can produce for 40 years, I mean, we have mines that have been producing since the 80s, right? Then, we're willing to come down a little bit on that hurdle rate. And the reason for it is because if you think of the gold cycles of the last 10, 20 years, you're bound to hit one or two, three gold cycles within that time frame, right? So even though we have that sort of strict, and I use that quote unquote investment filter, as long as the project has enough life ahead of it that it can hit a few gold cycles or copper cycles, because we're also into, we have copper mines as well, then, you know, then we're sort of willing to accept a lower IRR, but we're still looking at, you know, double digits, at least 10%.
Makes sense, because you have less variance if you have it over a long period of time, because it's going to be cyclically up and cyclically down, so maybe the threshold's not as high. So
yeah, exactly. You
accept a lower IRR on that type of project.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
And what, I guess, do you guys do with the projects that don't meet that? Do you just kind of bundle them some off someone else, or do you wait for operational efficiencies and technology to improve so that the projects, you know, extraction costs are able to come down to a point where it then eventually makes sense at $1,300 an ounce?
Yeah, I mean, and that's what we do, right, as well, is like we have a project that we're, you know, sort of sitting on because it doesn't quite meet our hurdles, but it's a significant asset, you know, upwards of 40 million ounces, you know, in the ground. So, you know, we wouldn't, you know, we're certainly not interested in divesting of that project, because, you know, eventually, you know, gold is one of those resources. It's like oil. Eventually you run out wherever you're drilling, right, or wherever you're mining for it. So at some point, you know, that project will be a lot more attractive into the future. And, you know, if gold remains high, that's not to say that our investment filter gold price wouldn't rise as well, right? Because, I mean, if you think back to 2008, as early as 2008, I mean, gold was $400, right? The financial crash of 2008 really, really skyrocketed gold prices. So,
yeah, no, for sure. And have you guys seen the cost of, I'm going to say, mining gold come down over the years? Like, when I think of oil and gas, you know, horizontal drilling made oil more accessible for many reservoirs that previously weren't accessible. Is that a similar story with gold, or has technology relatively stayed the same? I'm not actually sure what the mining process is like. I have no idea.
Yeah, no, the technology stayed fairly consistent. It's pretty much the same. There's been no sort of technological shift, if you wish. So the costs have stayed fairly flat, and I will say in the last few years they've come up, just like everybody else's production costs have come up, just, you know, because of COVID and the labor shortage and the parts shortages around the world, that sort of thing. So our costs have come up a little bit, but not to, you know, not to an unmanageable extent. But there's no sort of magic wand that we've come up with. But we are trying new technologies, for example, automated trucks. So if you think of a large open pit mine, I'm sure you've seen one on TV or something, you know what I mean, a commercial or something, you know, these massive trucks that are about the size of a two-story house that move dirt around. And, you know, a big part of the cost of operating those trucks is labor, right? So, one of the things we're doing is we're doing truck automation, where the truck can drive itself to a certain extent. And what that does, obviously, is you save on labor, but you also, you know, the truck doesn't need a brake, where as a person obviously needs a brake. And you know, you have the exchange of shifts where you lose, you know, it's all these little things where you lose, you know, maybe 15 minutes, but 15 minutes multiplied by 50 trucks, you know, is a lot of time where the trucks aren't being productive. So, those small technological advances that we're making, but there's been no sort of groundbreaking, especially for gold mining. Now, so some other mining have seen some advantages of bigger technological shift. If you think of potash, for example, some potash miners can do, it's basically groundwater injection, and then you sort of pump it back up, and then the potash comes up with it. So, but gold, you know, is usually found in hard rock, so that doesn't work for us. So,
so there's some complexities with rock, why it's relatively stayed the same on a technological advancement side of things, and capital costs, operational costs are relatively flat, other than, like I said, minor changes in technology that might reduce labor time, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. So what are some of the things that are exciting in the gold industry, other than, you know, it reaching all-time high, which is exciting, and the industry itself being gold? What about distribution and demand, or what are some things that you're focusing on right now? I think, you know, inflation obviously exists. I don't know if people are looking to gold more as real assets. So it'd be great to have your thoughts on gold in general and the market.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting conversation to have, because, you know, the issue with gold since 2008, 2009 was the inception of ETFs, where there's more paper gold that gets traded daily that exists in the world, right? If you took all the gold mined to date in the world and pulled it all together, probably would fill about maybe two Olympic-sized swimming pools. So if you think about, you know, it's not that much gold. Oh. But there's a lot more gold that gets traded daily in ETFs. So you don't need to hold that physical gold anymore. So there is physical applications for gold, dentistry being one of them, and then obviously jewelry. So the big markets are India, you know, China. They're big consumers of physical gold. But you know, what really drives that price of gold, you know, including the ETFs, is that flight to safety, right? It's that sort of risk-free asset that people, or at least inflation, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of an inflation-proof asset that people run to. Now, the interesting part is, it's an interesting part and a sad part at the same time, because gold is one of those assets, like I just said, that people, you know, flock to for a safe haven investment. But what that means is that often is that gold will climb when there's like chaos around the world, right? So when Russia invaded Ukraine, you saw a very fast uptick in gold price. COVID, you know, since COVID, whenever COVID hit, you know, gold went sort of through the roof, and has been stable there ever since COVID hit. So you know, it's still seen as that, safe haven investment, even though there's a lot of paper trading, but it's certainly not where it used to be in terms of, you know, the U.S. dollars used to be pegged to gold, right? And they got rid of that in the 70s. But that's the, you know, that's the.
So if, but you mentioned also ETFs aren't really, there's more paper trading happening right now than there is gold. So those ETFs, I guess, aren't really pegged to gold, or there's related to companies that are gold related. So if people are looking to gold, safe haven, I was going to say, if people are thinking about gold being a safe haven, then it looks like buying the ETFs maybe isn't the best solution, unless you're going to correct me here, which it sounds like you might be.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like if you think about the banking system. I mean, you know, the banking system is a money multiplier, where, you know, every dollar invested in a bank gets lent out 10 times over, right? So unless everybody came calling on that physical gold all at once, those ETFs are backed by physical gold. They're just allowed to multiply the amount of gold they're trading, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It's a little bit away from it being a safe haven.
Yeah. But if every, yeah, so, so, you know, if everybody flocked to those ETFs and said, I want my, sort of physical gold, it'd be a run on an ETF, I guess.
So do you guys see then, so do you guys then deal with mostly like retailers, or who is the biggest buyers for you guys? Is it, I'm assuming it's not individual shops or jewelers selling it. Do you guys, how does that work? So you guys obviously mine it, then I'm assuming there's somewhat of a market quality and things like that matter, but how does gold then get resold, or who are the buyers? I'm assuming it's not the average consumer that's looking for it as a safe haven, or is it?
Well, it's the average consumer that's looking for the safe haven in terms of the sort of retail investors, if you wish. I mean, obviously institutional investors invest in gold, either gold bars or gold mining companies. The difference between investing in a gold bar and investing into a gold mining company is you get operational leverage from a gold mining company. So, and what I mean by that is for sort of every $100 of gold price jump, I can deliver the equivalent of $350 worth of margin, if that makes sense. So it's that sort of multiplier effect on my free cash flow when gold goes up. So that's the operational leverage. Now, obviously, there's operational risks as well, right? It's a bit balanced that way. But I think where, the retail institutional investors are investing in that sense. But if to answer your question of who's buying the physical gold, it's usually banks.
It's banks, really. I did not expect that. I thought most of the gold was going to be jewelers, to be honest, or something like that.
No, banks. Well, banks buy them and then they distribute probably to a lower network, if I can call it that, like a broader network of jewelers, dentistry, whatever. But we sell mostly to banks.
Oh, interesting. I would not have expected that. I thought you guys had maybe buyers, like you said, in India or China that then, manufacture it and turn it into jewelry or something like that.
Well, it also depends where the gold comes from, Alex. So I'll give you an example. Here in Canada, the physical gold cannot leave Canada. So it gets sold in Canada. It still belongs to, I shouldn't say the queen, but it still belongs to the crown. So you're allowed to take it out of the ground. You're allowed to sell it, but you sell it within the borders of Canada.
In the US, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the U.S., it's not that you're not allowed to export it, but an interesting fact about U.S. gold is if you think the gold coin, the buffalo, the American buffalo gold coin, it's 1 ounce of gold. The law is, and that's in law in the U.S. is that gold to make those coins has to be U.S. mined gold.
Interesting. I did not know that either. So You're saying that gold mined in Canada. So is there then a different gold spot price for Canada? Because I'm assuming the demand in Canada for Canadian gold is not as high as global demand.
No, it still follows the global spot pricing. And I think, I shouldn't say it's not allowed to leave Canada. It is, but I don't know what the mechanism past us is. We're only allowed to sell to Canadian institutions, if that makes sense.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's interesting.
But once the banks have it, maybe they have some sort of treaty or whatever it is to export that gold. But
that's interesting. So maybe that's also why you're not selling direct to retailers. But interesting. Some of those nuances I had no idea about. Because I was going to say, once it gets manufactured and melted, like it seems like it's a fungible good, so to speak. So how do you even know where it comes from unless you literally have to have Canadian mines for Canadian gold and then U.S. mines for U.S. gold? So interesting little thoughts that I had no idea about. Fair enough. So what are some of the things right now, we're getting close to year end. So what are some of the things that you then have to focus on in your role and how has your career shifted and changed over the years? And what are you looking forward to? So kind of three questions in one there.
Well, so I'll answer the first one. So, this time of year for us is when we look at our life of mine. So we plan, we don't want any budget for next year. We plan for the next 40 years. Now, granted, we're going to be wrong, right? Because you're taking your best estimate of what 40 years from now looks like today, right? So, but none, we do that in order to plan where to drill the next hole. Does that make sense? Right. So you have to keep that pipeline of where's the next gold coming from. So we plan for 40 years. So this is this time of year. So Q3, before we enter year end, we need to have that sort of nailed down. So that's a busy time for us. And then also, one of the things here we do with those life of mines is that you look at whether or not the asset needs to be impaired. So if you bought an asset, with goodwill, you need to test it every year for impairment. And that's why also why we look at what that total sort of series of cash flows will look like over the next, 40 years. So we try and do most of our impairment testing now, while the LOMs are fresh, and also it takes some pressure off of year end, sort of a January time frame where you're already dealing with doing the whole audit. So if you can get a piece of it done before year end, then it just makes that process more efficient, right? So
Makes a ton of sense.
yeah. And what was your second question? Sorry.
My second question was, what is, I guess, your future look like? Because you've moved up at Barrick Gold, in this company. What are your plans for you personally?
Well, personally, I've got some. It's interesting because I just did AMP 83. We just finished in October, and we had to write that cover story. And so one of the things I'm big into sort of ventures and certainly speaking with some of the faculty there, it spiked that interest again, right? So one of the things that I'd like to get done is personally. Is I'd like to climb Denali in Alaska, and also I ride motorcycles, like sort of adventure bikes. So do the Alaska Highway all the way from Alberta all the way to Anchorage. So
Wow.
that's one of my goals. Now I think I might have an opportunity to go to Everest, not the top, just the base, but nonetheless, that might be an opportunity for me in May. So I'm looking into that trip and just whether or not I can sort of fit it in with work. And
And I'm going to say Alberta to Anchorage, you're doing that in the summer, right?
absolutely. Because in the wintertime, I'm going to Anchorage in December. In the wintertime, there's maybe an hour of sunlight.
Oh, wow. Yeah, good.
Yeah, but in the summertime. It was shocking to me. I went there in June of 22, and kind of woke up for no reason at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning, and I could see some lights coming through the window shades of the hotel room, and I opened the window shades and I'm like, it's bright out. The sun never really sets in the summer, so but yes, absolutely, we're doing that in the summertime.
Yeah. And Anchorage, is there something Barrick related over in that area, or why the few trips to Alaska?
Yeah, so we have an asset called Donlin. So that's one of the assets that I was sort of referencing earlier. It's a bit of a tricky asset in terms of getting to that hurdle rate. So it's located about 350 miles sort of northwest of Anchorage. So it's kind of a middle of nowhere Alaska. But that's the one. It's got about close to 40 million ounces in the ground. It's just figuring out how to profitably get it out of the ground.
Yeah, and then apparently now having to drive it through Canada or wherever, unless you're gonna, do it all up there.
Exactly.
And then having to deal with 40 million ounces crossing the Canadian border. Good luck. Tell the border patrol officer what you got in there.
Yeah.
But really interesting things that you have to deal with. Was there anything else that you want to touch on that we didn't really get into? I was trying to just speak a little about your company, personally, we got into a little bit.
Well, so it's funny you asked. I was going through because you had sent through that sort of list of potential questions, and there was one that I kind of got stuck with because it was the one where you said, what's the most unique thing you've had to deal with in your career? And I said, there's so many of them, but I think part of my success I attribute to is raising my hand to doing something that's sort of outside of finance. Could be managing a project or something of the sort. And I think that has a lot more power than people give it credit for. And I think it's uncomfortable to step out of your comfort zone, right, by nature. But we often meet with, so one of the things we do as Barrick Leadership is when we go to mine sites or sort of regional service centers, is we often, it's almost like a speed dating thing that we do. So we sit all the executives in an inner circle, and in the outer circle, we have some young graduates or sort of young professionals that we get to speak to for 3 minutes. And that's probably the most powerful piece of advice that I give to them is, don't be afraid to raise your hand. And nobody, because, and you might fail if you're doing something that's sort of out of your area of expertise. But, I like to think that at Barrick, we certainly have a team that wouldn't let you fail and that would help you out. But it's those types of initiatives that sort of help you stand out from peers, right? If that makes sense. Like I said, I think it certainly helped me with my career. It was one of the things I was big on, and I did early in my career is working at mine sites, is I wouldn't just sit in my office and sort of crunch numbers all day. Oftentimes I'd put my hard hat and steel toe boots out and get out in the field and just learn, right? I like to learn, and it was, it's always interesting to me, all the just all the intricacies of well, to your point earlier, is why do you mine a specific product that way, right? Where why do we mine here this way versus another way? It's just, don't not being afraid of sort of putting yourself out there will certainly help, propel that your career at any given point in time. That's my belief anyways, but that's some of the advice I give to the younger generation that we speak to.
No, that's a really interesting point because, learning, there's infinite things to learn, and unless you're going to put yourself out there and do something uncomfortable that you don't know, you're not going to learn the new things, right? You're just going to go deeper into your echo chamber, so to speak, if you just keep focusing on the things you do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. But I think,
Well,
yep, the advice that someone gave me that I thought was good advice is, it was one of my professors when I was doing my undergrad. He said, don't take yourself too seriously, but take what you do very seriously. And I think, we all, we're all fairly smart people, right? And you come out of school thinking, and I know it all. I just graduated from university, right? And then you go into the workforce and realize you don't know anything.
No, it's a very valid point. And you bring up a lot of points, or you bring up a lot of good thoughts for me as well, on that side of things. And it's something I maybe have to think about as well, to do what I to take what I do more seriously, and to not think about the outcome. Or you said it very well. I very much butchered it there, but that's why I have to think about it more. So that was a very good piece of advice.
No worries.
What do you think the next 10, 20 years has in store for you as well, is one of the questions I like hearing what people think.
To be honest, it's a question I've asked myself, quite a bit. I'm hoping to get some of those sort of personal achievements sort of checked off, and not work so much, probably since the beginning of my career. I haven't taken more than a week off at a time. So, probably just get some of those personal achievements checked off. I want to keep growing in my career. I get bored if I stay stagnant too long. So, there's obviously some promotions that I'd like to get. If I had my way, I'd have it right away. But obviously in the near future, if I could. But I'm not pigeonholed to mining. I think CFO and operational, financial acumen, or whatever you want to call it, it is a very transferable skill in terms of industries. So I wouldn't be opposed to changing industries at some point. I think it'd be interesting. But for now, I certainly enjoy my career at Barrick. So, in no rush to go anywhere. But I don't know. It's funny because I think one of the other questions was kind of how you got here. When I was doing my undergrad, the only thing I wanted to do in life was being an investment banker, and I graduated in 2009, so there wasn't a whole lot of investment banking offers being thrown out there, right? It still worked out for me. I work with investment bankers almost daily, and I work on M&A transactions and valuations, and so I do a lot of the same type of work. So it kind of worked out that way. But so I, obviously, that was my only goal back then, and it obviously went very differently for me, and to the good. So, I don't know. It's hard to tell what the next 10, 20 years will bring for me. Maybe I'll just strike it rich somewhere, and I can retire early and just sit on a board somewhere.
I love it. Well, how has life turned out differently or the same as you would have thought 20 years ago? So 20 years ago, what did you think life was going to be like?
Well, like I said, I thought I was going to be an investment banker, dressed in a suit every day. And now, the thought of being dressed in a suit every day, just doesn't sit that well with me. So I guess I've changed in that sense. The other funny thing is, when I was younger, I thought, kids aren't for me. And now I have three boys, and obviously I wouldn't, trade a minute with them. But so it's kind of funny, especially looking back. I'm 40 today, so 20 years ago I was 20 years old, so I was pretty young. So your mindset's very different, right? At 20, I was like, oh, I'm gonna be single my whole life, and no kids, and just be free. You quickly realize that, that'd be a kind of hard life. But it's like I said, it's worked out. I certainly not what I was envisioning back then, but I guess for that same reason, kind of hard to envision now what the next 20 years will be like, right? So, but
For sure.
yeah.
Well, no, I appreciate your time, appreciate you
I
sharing your
appreciate you having
story.
me. Yeah, I
Yeah,
appreciate you having me.
love a chance to connect.